come back to our motivation. And since we've been talking about death in the Lamrim, let's rejoice that at least since the last teaching, we didn't die, although we certainly could have. And so just take a minute and see what you did the last week, since the last teaching. And did we remember death? Did we create virtue? Did we let our mind get distracted? So remembering our mortality, the brevity of this life, then let's have a strong determination to purify our minds, our karma, to accumulate vast amounts of merit, to listen to teachings, to plant the seeds in our mind stream, and to contemplate and meditate on those teachings in order to understand them correctly and transform our mind. And let's do this for the benefit of all the sentient beings. And let's not have all sentient beings be some abstraction that we routinely recite but don't have any feeling for. So think of individuals, think of different life forms. Think of the whole sky filled with stars and how many living beings having so many different kinds of experiences out in the universe. And think that they're all like me, wanting happiness and not suffering. There's no reason why my happiness is more important than theirs. And so let's generate a mind of compassion that wants living beings to be free of their dukkha, and the great resolve to get involved in bringing that about. And then the bodhicitta aiming for full awakening. This very time when we're sitting here in a nice, safe, pleasant place, 2 hours ago, the strongest hurricane ever recorded hit the coast of Mexico. When it was at sea, it was 200 miles per hour. It slowed to 165 when it hit the western coast of Mexico, and so they're anticipating that everything will, it's a category 5, and they don't have category 6 because they figure after 5 everything's flattened. So that's what they're expecting, except for maybe some places where they have concrete, reinforced concrete bunkers or something like that. So a lot of the places on the, that place on the Mexican shore are small fishing villages, you know, where the housing is made thatched, yeah. And then tourist places. So it's near Puerto Vallarta. Yeah. So, yeah, so they say it's the strongest one that has ever been recorded here historically. So, you know, why these people are undergoing who knows what right now. We're sitting here very comfortably. So, you know, as a show of support for them and empathy for them, then since we have the opportunity to listen to the Dharma, let's really listen attentively and put it into practice and keep them in mind, especially as the beings that we're doing it for and whose welfare we'll dedicate it for. Have any of you ever been in a hurricane?
Yeah. I've been one once. One we called to Oregon or tornado, same thing?
No.
I was in a tornado.
Yeah. I was in a tropical storm once, and that was really wild, and that's like not even stage one hurricane, so I can't even imagine, you know. What
we would get the edges of them, but...
Okay, so we've been discussing the benefit, well, the disadvantages of not remembering death. Yeah. And I bet a week ago, all those people along the Mexican coast never thought that in a week they might be dead. Because just yesterday, it was the Hurricane Patricia was a tropical storm. And it, like, woof, so, the disadvantages of not remembering death is that we don't practice the Dharma, or if we do start to practice, we put it off, or if we don't put it off and do it, then our practice isn't pure because it's really infiltrated by the eight worldly concerns, the thought of that happiness of only this life. Yeah, which, and that thought is like so ingrained in us, it's outrageous. And yet that, the presence or absence of that thought, seeking only the happiness of this life, is the demarcation line between what is Dharma practice and what isn't. So when you really think of it, then it makes us question, well, how much Dharma practice have I done? Now, when hasn't the eight worldly concerns been running around in my mind? So along that line, then we went into, we talked about the eight worldly concerns in depth, and then we've been talking about the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampas. Yeah, and these 10 innermost jewels, like I was saying yesterday, in one way we could say that they're quite extreme, you know, to think in this way. But in another way, just even, you know, taking the time to think in this way and trying to train our mind in this way, already like really makes the mind settle down. Yeah. And really dispels the dissatisfaction and the complaining mind. So we start up. I'll just review. We did the four trusting acceptances. So as our innermost outlook on life, being willing to accept the Dharma with total trust. So really making the Dharma the center of our life and totally trusting it. And then as our innermost attitude towards the Dharma, being willing to accept with total trust, even becoming a beggar. So not caring at all about the happiness of this life and, you know, being willing, you know, having a mind that's so focused on the Dharma that if you became a beggar, so what? Yeah. And then having... as our innermost attitude towards becoming a beggar, being willing to accept even dying. Yeah. Yeah, so if we don't have enough food to sustain us for our Dharma practice, instead of giving up the practice and going getting a high-paying job so that we can eat lots of food, we're resigned, you know, just to really continue practicing, because that's the most valuable thing in our life, even if we should starve to death. And then the fourth entrustment as our innermost attitude towards death, being completely, being willing to accept with total trust having to die alone without friends and, in an empty place and without anybody even knowing. Okay? Because, you know, our dedication to the Dharma is so strong that we're going to practice no matter what and not give up out of attachment for food and comfort, not give up because out of fear of death, but, you know, maintaining the awareness of the preciousness of the opportunity at, to practice and really keeping on with practice. So I was thinking about this in terms of our monastic conference these last few days, where so many people were talking about having enough support. We have enough support. Yeah? None of us are starving to death. And even if we were, we should be meditating on these four entrustments instead of how can we round up more support. You know, it's... You know, when you really think about it, it's true. Like I said, this is a very radical way to think. And it's hard to think this way, but just even trying to, steers our mind in the right direction. You know, it's like you have to have that intensity of a wish to attain an awakening that, you know, you just go through whatever comes your way without giving up. Yeah? So whatever the situation is, you meet it head on, practice as best as you can. Don't give up. Don't go, oh, I'm hungry. Okay, let's stop my Dharma practice and go work at McDonald's or go work on Wall Street and, you know, then I can have a comfortable life. And no, we really stick with the practice. But, you know, we're not even challenged like that in that kind of way. So sometimes I think of the people in communist countries, you know, the Buddhists in communist countries. And, you know, when the communists started really repressing religion. And you know, what did these people do? And how much courage some of them had. How easily some of them gave up. And how courageous some of them really were. And so, you know, we have no idea what's going to come in our life. So it can be very, very helpful in our meditation to imagine those kind of situations. What would happen, you know, if we were stuck in a hurricane? What would, you know, how would we work with our mind? What would we do if we lived in a country where religion was repressed and you could be imprisoned for trying to practice? What would we do if we were imprisoned? How would we hold our mind together? Yeah? And just imagining these kind of situations, and then asking ourselves, well, how would I practice the Dharma? What meditations would I rely on to keep my mind balanced, to keep myself from totally falling into a feeling of hopelessness and depression? You know, because sometimes you're in that situation, you can't get out. You have to live with it. So to think in advance, you know, how would I practice? I think that way of thinking can be very, very helpful to us. And then we practice thinking like that, you know, so that should that situation come about, then you know, we have some experience. And then the three Vajra convictions, which are also called three abandonments. So these are the fifth to the seventh of the Ten Kadampa jewels. So the first one is to go ahead without consideration for what others think. Ah, I can't do that. I care what others think about me. My friends don't like me. My relatives are criticizing me. I want to have a good reputation, and they all think I'm crazy for being a Buddhist. Okay, so to give up caring what other people think. Or even, you're in a Dharma center. Yeah? And so, okay, those people understand why you practice, but they criticize you. Oh, I don't want my Dharma friends to criticize me. I want to have a good reputation. I want them all to like me and approve me, say nice things about me. Yeah, so to even be willing to give that up. What do you think? Can you give that up?
I watched it play itself out this week.
Yeah?
My attachment to reputation. Mm. You know, wanting people to think well of me. Just kept coming up.
Yep. Yeah. I want to look like a good monastic in front of all my other monastic brothers and sisters. Yeah? I don't want to look like I'm a dumb person who doesn't practice. I want to look holy. But not too holy, because then they'll think I'm phony. Okay. And then the second one is to keep the constant company of the wisdom of our commitments. Okay, so abandon thinking about what others think of us because we practice, and abandon caring about that what they think of us is important. So it's kind of related to the first one, but a little bit more intense. Yeah. So guard our practice and unify it with our life. No matter what names people call you, no matter what they say about you or do to you or think of you or whatever, you know. The Dharma is our real refuge, and we're focused on that. And that's what we depend on, is the three jewels. And we let that carry us through. Yeah. So we do that so that we can not just practice the Dharma, but really keep our precepts and keep our commitments, even though other people around us may be trying to entice us to do something else. Yeah. Being able to stand up to them and say, no, I have precepts, and I'm not going to do that. Even they call you names and yell and scream, and even they criticize the Dharma. To, you know, they have that kind of inner strength and certitude about what we're doing. And then the third of the Vajra convictions is to carry on continuously without getting caught up in useless concerns. Okay, so practicing continuously without our mind going off to some form of chocolate or another. Yeah, whatever your variety of chocolate is, if it's a relationship or a comfortable bed or you know, your reputation or who knows what, yeah. Okay, so to really remain steady. So there's nothing wrong with having friends, there's nothing wrong with having wealth, but when these things distract us from our practice, or when we break our precepts on account of them, then, you know, we're on the downward slope. Okay, and then the last three of the, to make the ten, are the three mature attitudes towards being expelled, finding, and attaining. Okay?
Mature?
Mature, yeah.
Mature.
Attitudes. Yeah, towards being expelled, finding, and attaining. So this is number 8, 9, and 10 of the 10 jewels. So being willing to be expelled from the ranks of so-called normal people because we don't share their limited values. Okay? So having a mature attitude, being willing to be expelled from all your social circle, you know, all your colleagues at work, even all your Dharma friends, even your family, because you have values that don't agree with those, with their values. You believe in future lives. You believe in the functioning of the law of cause and effect. And you're willing to live by that and stand by that no matter what. No matter whether your kitty loves you or your kitty abandons you.
Well, that's one just too far
now. Okay. The second one is being willing to be regarded amongst the ranks of dogs. Okay. So even we receive poor food, we still courageously take on hardships. Yeah, and again, we just, you know, if people look at us like we're dirty beggars, stupid people, you know, we join the rank of dogs, it's okay. Yeah. So Milarepa used to say, this, I like this quote, he said, "In degenerate times, hypocrites are honored. Spiritual shysters are more in demand than gold and jewels, while sincere, humble practitioners are tossed aside like pebbles." And it's true, you know? So are we willing to be among the ranks of dogs, or do we want to be some kind of important Dharma practitioner, you know, who struts around with a bunch of groupies following us who are all going, "Oh, my Lama is enlightened." But you see that, don't you? Yeah? Not only with Tibetans, but especially with some Westerners. Yeah? So, you know, it's putting on a good show. You can gain a lot of popularity. I remember one time, I wasn't there, but I heard about this later, my teachers was teaching at Root Institute in Bodhgaya, and there was also a Western teacher who was apparently very charismatic, but also controversial, as it turned out. And people flooded to hear him, and very few of them went to hear my teacher. And I was going, my goodness, yeah, because people were interested in pizzazz and charisma, which is not one of the ten qualities of a Mahayana guru. So I felt really bad, you know, because my teacher, those Kenzo Jumpa Tepcho, you can't find anybody better than that. And people were running off to, you know, this other person. Okay, and then the third mature attitude is being completely involved in attaining the divine rank of a Buddha. Okay, so being willing to be expelled from the ranks of so-called normal people, being willing to be regarded as joining the ranks of dogs, and being completely involved in attaining the rank of a Buddha. Yeah, so this really shifts our mind away from the happiness of this life, doesn't it? Yeah, to turn our mind away from, you know, what other people care about us, what other people call us, and just really relying on the inner happiness that comes from practicing the Dharma and, you know, gaining the realizations and joining the ranks of the Buddha. So I find it very helpful to remember these and to think about them and imagine, you know, just even imagine having that kind of inner strength, you know, what would that feel like? Pretty remarkable. Okay, so we'll go back to we'll finish with the rest of the six benefits of remembering death. Okay, so number four, we've only gotten up to number three so far. So number four is that remembering death is important in the... Okay, number four is if we don't remember death, we'll lose determination to practice earnestly at all times. So we may practice, but our practice won't have intensity, it won't have strength, it won't have consistency. Yeah, sounds like my practice, you know? So you just kind of do all your things by rote, you know, every day. What mantra was I supposed to say in there? What practice was I doing? I can't even remember which one I was doing. Yeah, so practice lacks intensity. Have you ever had that happen? Yeah? And your practice lacks strength, it lacks consistency. Yeah. So, I mean, the only thing that keeps you doing anything is the fact that you made commitments to your gurus and you're not going to break those. But then some people even think, well, I just, you know, fooey kapooey, you know, I won't even do that. Okay, so that's because we don't remember death. So we think, you know, our mind just goes towards creature comfort. We don't think that this life could end sometime soon and I could soon find myself in another realm of existence. Yeah. So by not thinking about that, then, you know, there's no hurry to practice the Dharma at all. Then the fifth disadvantage of not remembering death is we will create a lot of destructive actions which not only cause our own unfortunate birth, but obscure our mind and prevent us from gaining liberation. So again, you know, the whole thing hinges in this thing of not remembering death is that if we don't remember death, then our mind is focused on the happiness of this life, and the mind focused on the happiness of this life is just looking out for my happiness now. And it will do whatever we possibly can to get it without concern that the actions we do are harmful to other beings, that the actions are against our precepts, that the actions are destructive ones. Yeah, but the attachment to the happiness of this life is so strong that we're really like those donkeys with a ring in our nose and we just follow that attachment. And it's true, isn't it? Yeah? It's really true, that attachment to the happiness of this life, completely. Yeah? We bow down and salute it and never disobey it. And that's what keeps us constantly being reborn in samsara. And then the sixth disadvantage of not remembering death is that we'll die with regret. So why will we die with regret? Because we'll waste all of our time doing stupidagios. We won't purify, we won't accumulate merit, we won't listen to teachings. And then at the time of death, you know, we spend our whole life, you know, taking care of our friends, making sure people like us, protecting our reputation, gathering wealth, gathering people's approval, and all this stuff. And at the time of death, all of that just vanishes. And we have nothing to take with us except the seeds of the destructive actions that we've done. And so then, you know, so much regret wells up inside at the time of death. And I can't imagine what that would be like, you know? Can you imagine, like, you just spent your whole life just pleasure, seeking pleasure, all these things. And then death comes, and you look, and you're somebody who's known the Dharma, you know? Not like somebody who doesn't know the Dharma, who, you know, is spaced out. But you know the Dharma, and you consciously made choices to do other things instead of practicing it. And then there you are dying, and you realize, wow, I could have, you know, spent this time practicing, but instead I spent it making pancakes and, you know, whatever your thing is, playing golf, going bowling, yeah, reading the news day in and day out. And then, you know, you have nothing left to take with you at the time of death. And it must be incredibly painful, that kind of regret that sets in. You know, especially if you've put so much intention on possessions and reputation and physical strength, physical beauty. And there it is at the time of death. All of those things are going bye-bye. Yeah, so what you work so hard for is completely like sand running through your fingertips. And what's sticking to your hand is all the destructive karma that we did to obtain all of that. Okay? So, you know, if we really think deeply about these disadvantages of not remembering death, then it really helps us overcome our laziness of remembering it. Yeah, because we are lazy to remember it, aren't we? Yeah, I'm going to die. I'll think about it mañana, a la mañana. Yeah? And then we think about death and we say, oh yeah, I might die, but you know, mañana and la mañana. Not now, it's, you know, sometime, some other time. Okay. Then the next outline is the six benefits of remembering death. So that one was the stick, this one's the carrot. And, you know, you see throughout the Lam Rim that so many times we'll have this, you know, the disadvantages of not doing something and the benefits of doing it, you know, because this is what helps us gain a correct motivation. Okay, so the benefits of remembering death. Yeah, we'll act meaningfully. We'll have inner discipline, so nobody needs to force us to practice. And we won't waste time. Wow. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, you have inner discipline, so even you wake up in the morning, you're still groggy, maybe you don't feel 100%, but you don't sit there and bellyache, you get up and go to the hall and do your practice. Yeah? And we won't waste time kind of saying, yeah, I'm reading this Dharma book, but what email just came in? And then, you know, it's somebody on Facebook asking you to be their friend, and then you have to go look them up and see what they're doing and decide if you want to be their friend. And then that leads you to another friend on Facebook and another friend. And then pretty soon, oh, time to go to bed. You know, forget about doing practice or finishing what I was reading. Okay, so remembering death prevents those kind of you know, going off in left field somewhere. Then second, all of our positive actions will be powerful and they will be effective, you know, because we're unattached to worldly things. So we won't act with ignorance, anger, and attachment regarding them. And we'll be able to focus and concentrate on what we're doing. Yeah. So if we remember death, we'll naturally be more generous. Now we'll give things away because we know that we can't take them with us. And better to give them away and create merit than hang on to them and, you know, even be hanging on to them at the time we're dying. And, so we'll be more generous, and we also won't harm others if we remember death. You know, because this awareness of death makes us always monitor, well, you know, what am I doing and what kind of result is it going to bring in the future? Yeah, so that mind that's always thinking about the results of our actions really makes us very mindful of our precepts and our ethical values, and it really increases our introspective awareness so that we're aware of what we're doing. Yeah. So that, if we remember death, they say it makes Dharma practice much easier. So remembering death shouldn't make us depressed, like, oh God, I'm going to die. But, you know, it makes us ask, well, what's important in my life? And then let's stay steady on what's important without doubting that, without caring what other people think, and just doing what we know is useful, meaningful, beneficial. And then at the time we die, we can feel happy. Okay, so remembering death, the third one, the benefit is it's important in the beginning of our practice, so it gets us going on the path. So here even the example of the Buddha, you know, what made him renounce, become a wandering mendicant, you know, he saw aging, sickness, and death, so... Death makes you wonder, yeah, what's going to happen at the time of death? And what's the meaning of my life? And what can I take with me and what can't I take with me? Yeah, so it really gets us on track. So the Buddha started practicing after he saw the dead person in the market. Amilarepta, started practicing when he thought of the deaths that he caused, because he killed like 34, 35 people, and when he thought of that, and then also when the death of his sorcery teacher's patron, that made him start wondering about the meaning of life and what's going to happen after death. And Gampopa, he started practicing after his wife died. That's what really jolted him. Yeah. So we can often see for ourselves, sometimes, you know, the death of somebody who is very close and dear, really it affects us and makes us look at life in a quite different way. Fourth. So it's remembering death is important in the middle of our practice. So it helps us to persevere and not lose interest. Yeah, because sometimes we start practicing, okay. And then we practice. And then, you know, we have all these expectations. We want the bells and whistles and, you know, a Buddha appearing before us and, you know, golden light shining down on us. And we want all this stuff and it's not coming. And I've been practicing for, you know, 2 months already. Or maybe 2 years, or maybe 2 decades, it doesn't matter. But, you know, I've been doing something, and you know, where's the golden light that's supposed to be showering down? Where's the kundalini bliss that's supposed to be rising up? Yeah, nothing's happening. Yeah. Oh, the only thing that's happening is my knees hurt from doing so many prostrations, and my back hurts from sitting there and, you know, and doing mantra recitations, and even my thumb hurts from moving the mala, You know, and my fingers are so uncomfortable holding them like this. You know, I want to hold them like this or like this. I have to hold them like this. Yeah. So, you know, remembering death helps us persevere and not give up. Because it's tempting, isn't it? I mean, what Bhikkhu Bodhi said, was it yesterday or, you know, about the young Westerners coming to Sri Lanka and ordaining and meditating 25, 26 hours a day for a year, and then after a year knocking on his kuti door, Bhante, can I talk to you? And then, you know, disrobing and leaving. And so when we have high expectations, instead of having the long-term view, we have these high expectations, then that's what happens. Yeah. And then sometimes you see your Dharma friends disrobe, and then you go, oh no, you know, what happened to them? They disrobe, this is terrible. If they disrobe so easily, then what about me? Then am I going to disrobe? And, you know, you get really worried, you start to doubt yourself. You know, they were a much better practitioner than me, but they couldn't make it. What's going to happen to me? Yeah. And actually, right before I ordained, I was in Dharamsala, and the translator at the library and one of the nuns at the library, he was a monk, she was a nun, fell in love. And it was right before I ordained, so they were like both really close students of my teacher. And they disrobed and went off, and it terrified me, totally terrified me, because they were both people that I really respected a lot, you know? And I thought, you know, like if these people who I respect a lot can fall in love, then what in the world is going to happen to me? And it scared me so much that it made me really be much more careful in my relationships with people. Yeah, because I thought if that can happen to them, then it can happen to me. So I can't just kind of, you know, allow myself to look at all the attractive guys that go by, because that's going to be poison for me. I have to really, really toe the line here. So it actually, looking back on it, it had a very good effect on me. Although I know some people, when their friends disrobe, then they get really discouraged because of it. But for me, actually, sometimes that kind of wisdom fear can be very good for us. Yeah, it wakes us up out of, that kind of stuff. Okay, then the fifth one is that remembering death is important at the end of our study and practice. So again, it keeps us focused on our beneficial goals. So even the bodhisattvas remember death. And really treasure their life and use their time wisely and stay focused on their spiritual goals and how beneficial that is. And then the sixth benefit of remembering death is that we'll die happily and pleasantly. So instead of death being something that terrifies us, we'll have prepared our mind for it, and so when it comes, we relax, we meditate, we let go. Like the analogy I gave in the afternoon of that bird taking off and flying. So for very pure practitioners, dying becomes very happy, like going home. Yeah. For middling practitioners, the mind is happy and there's no worry, no regret. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah, to be able to die, no regret, no worry. You die with confidence. You know you're not going to have a lower rebirth. You know that, you know, because of what you did in this life, you'll have another good rebirth. You'll be able to continue practicing. That would be very nice, wouldn't it? And even for lower practitioners, if, you know, remembering death makes it so that they aren't upset or bothered at death. They don't get afraid. Yeah, so even death comes, then, okay, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I've been preparing for it. I don't need to be afraid. Yeah, I can do my best. I can relax. Instead of, but my whole identity is leaving, you know? And I'm separating from all these people that I care about, and I don't want to separate from them, and my whole ego identity is dissolving. I don't know who I am, and maybe I'm going to become non-existent, and, you know, all my wealth, all my possessions that were my security that made it so I never had to worry about anything. Yeah, now it's all vanishing, and, you know, how can I go into my next life without my credit card? Yeah? How am I going to get what I need in my next life? I won't have any money. Okay, so you die with a lot of fear. So, maybe I'll tell you the story. I referred to it earlier in the previous talk about this one old monk who died. So let me tell you the whole story. So I was at Tushita. This was, I don't know, a really long time ago. And below Tushita there were these mud and brick, mud and stone houses actually, where some of the older monks lived. And, you know, it was mud and stone, and they cooked on their kerosene stoves, and their floor was dirt. And there's a little, you know, there were, I don't know, maybe 6, 7 of them in their own huts there. They had a little community. So one day I was up at Tushita, and somebody comes, a Westerner comes running up the hill, and says, I just found this old monk, you know, as I was walking up here, he was sick, and he, you know, was like lying on the floor, on the ground outside, and we got to do something to help him. So there was one woman up there who was a nurse, so she went down, and they moved him back into his hut. And in the meantime, the director of Tushita jumped in the jeep and raced down to Delhi Hospital, you know, rushing in saying, he's dying, you know, because he was hemorrhaging inside, yeah. And my job, because I went down there to help, so he was hemorrhaging inside. They put a piece of plastic under him to catch all the stuff that was coming out of him. So periodically, somebody from inside would bring the plastic out to me filled with his guts, and I would throw it over the side of the hill and give them the plastic back to put back under him, because he was just hemorrhaging. It was really something. And so the Western monk, you know, arrives at Delhi Hospital. He's dying, you know, come save him. And the doctor comes up, they rush up the hill, you know, and go into the room, and the doctor looks at him and says, yeah, you're right, he's dying, and there's nothing I can do. And it really pointed out the differences, because at that time his friends, the old monk's friends, had gone off to do a puja somewhere. So the Westerners were like freaked out, you know, we got to go get the doctor, we've got to save him, do this, run here, run there, what are we going to do? Ah! You know, and then the doctor says, you know, can't do anything. Meanwhile, his friends arrive back, and they find out what's happening, and one of them goes in, to check and comes out and says, yeah, he's dying, very calmly. They went and set up the altar to do the self-initiation practice of this monk's chief deity. You know, then we all sat down, crowded in this little room, not in his room, in another one of their rooms, doing the self-initiation for several hours. Meanwhile, there was, I think Venerable Sinla was there, and then this other woman who was a nurse, inside helping him. And like I said, he wanted to sit up, he couldn't, then he wanted to do lie in position, he couldn't, so then they put him in the position of his deity. So we finished doing the self-initiation, came out, and Geshe Jampa Wangdu, yeah, do you remember him? So he went into this monk's room, he had died by that time, and they had put his chugu over him. And he checked the signs, I guess, of where the heat was leaving, and he came out of the room with this big smile on his face. You know, his friend had just died, and he's smiling, and he said, this is really good. Yeah? And so then, you know, did some more prayers and everything like that. By that time, it was quite late at night. So it was really quite remarkable, you know, and it sticks in my mind because the big difference between his friends, who were so calm, knew exactly what to do, yeah, weren't freaked out, and the Westerners who were running around like chickens without their heads, who couldn't do anything to help. Really, made things quite clear. And meanwhile, I mean, this monk was quite relaxed because he was the one telling the people taking care of him, you know, what to do and how to put his body and everything. So he knew exactly what to do. So you see a death like this of somebody who really practices. And then it gives you confidence. Yeah, this can be done. Kyabje Ling Rinpoche, my novice preceptor, when he died sitting up, and then he stayed and took dham for 13 days, you know, meditating before his consciousness left. You know, again in Dharamsala. So, you know, pretty amazing when you see this kind of thing and hear these stories. So it gives you some inspiration to practice. And then even Annie Michelle, you remember her? Annie Michelle? She was a French nun. And some people thought she was kind of odd. She would always sit below Rinpoche's window and just recite Om Mani Padme Hum day and night, you know? I got along quite well with her. Anyway, she died a few months ago. She was at Nalanda and apparently, you know, again, stayed in meditation for several days afterwards. Yeah. And Rinpoche told the monks to take very good care of her. You had a question?
I was just wondering, how was your mind at first when you were dumping the guts? Was that a little bit intense?
It was intense, and it was, you know, it was like, yeah, I'm throwing the guts over the hill, and this is what's happening, and this is what I need to do, because we were all in it together. We were all in it together, doing what we could to help. Yeah. But, you know, it's a real teaching about the foulness of the body. If you think the inside of the body is anything beautiful. Any other questions? Yeah? Oh, okay.
That first goes back to the 10 innermost jewels.
Uh-huh.
Someone said, meditating on them this week, I got caught a bit on the first of the 3 Vajra abandonments. There must be a balance between going ahead and practicing, and practice not being all about me. Could you speak to this?
Okay. So going ahead and practicing, but without practicing, being all about me. Sometimes you find that when people are new to the Dharma and they really want to practice a lot and go to teachings and go to retreats, and then their family says, we don't want you to do that, then they say, oh, I'm really selfish. Yeah? You know, Buddhism talks about compassion. It says that I should do what others want to benefit them. And I'm being really selfish wanting to go to teachings and do retreats because my family wants me to go on the family vacation and they want me to be part of the family. So out of compassion for them, I shouldn't be attached to Buddhism. Yeah? So you hear this a lot. Yeah? That's the incorrect way of thinking. Yeah? That's the incorrect way of thinking. If your Dharma practice is like, I want to get some powers so that I can fly in the sky and everybody's going to think I'm famous and fantastic, then, yeah, there's some eight-worldly concerns involved. Yeah? But if you're really sincerely wanting to practice and your family's objecting, it's not compassionate to say, I'll go out to dinner in the movies with my family, you know, and give up my Dharma practice because that way I'll make them happy. No, that's done out of attachment. Okay? So I know when I ordained, you know, my family was not happy at all. But when I thought about it, yeah, if I lived the life my family wanted, they still wouldn't be happy. I couldn't prevent them from getting old and sick and dying. I would create a ton of negative karma. I would be born in a lower rebirth. And then forget about being able to benefit them in a future life. I couldn't even benefit myself. And in addition, this life, they're not going to be totally happy. Whereas if I practice the Dharma, they may be unhappy now, but if I practice well, yeah, and I dedicate to be able to benefit them in the future, and I am able to get a good rebirth and continue on the path, then it's worthwhile. Yeah, they may be a little bit unhappy this lifetime, but then I'll be able to really repay their kindness in a future lifetime by teaching them the Dharma. Yeah. So this thing, you know, when you hear about compassion, then we often compassion, attachment gets mixed up with compassion. Yeah? And we sacrifice the Dharma to please somebody's worldly desire. And that's exactly what is being talked about. Okay? So, like I said, you know, if you're practicing Dharma with because you want to get offerings and status and things like that, definitely that's the wrong motivation. But if you're practicing with a good motivation, you know, don't worry about people not being happy with you. Because you know what? Whatever you do in life, they're not going to be happy with you. It's true, isn't it? Even you do 10 backflips a day to try and please people, they're not going to be happy. They're going to say, your backflip wasn't perfect. And I'm tired of backflips. I want you to do somersaults. You know? It's like trying to please worldly people is impossible. Look at your own mind. Has any other sentient being ever succeeded in pleasing you forever and making you eternally happy? No. So why do you think you're going to be able to make somebody else eternally happy? That is selfishness, isn't it? I'm so special that this person needs me to be happy. Next question.
What does that mean, that death for the good practitioner is like going home?
literally home. It means going home to the fundamental innate mind of clear light. Yeah, that's what your home is, the extremely subtle mind and using it to meditate on emptiness. It doesn't mean moving back into your house as a ghost. That's not the meaning. You said there were three questions?
Why do some people die with so much drama, yet animals who are considered a lower rebirth die with so much dignity, even if they are supposed to be in so much pain?
So, the one is some people die with drama, and then some, but
animals
die rebirth. They die with dignity. It has to do with what karma is ripening at that time, and what's going on in your mind. And you know, if you're dying and there's a lot of anger in your mind because you're really ticked off at dying. And you think the world has, you know, is not being fair, then boy, there's going to be a lot of drama. Or you die with attachment, you know, cling, 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 cling. Again, a lot of drama. Okay? Or if, you know, depending on how you die, what's happening with your body. Yeah, sometimes the body, I mean, you can have spasms, you can have seizures, there can be all sorts of things. Somebody could be moaning in pain. Yeah, so it depends on the karma they've created. Even they're human beings. Yeah. And you think, you know, sometimes of people who spent their whole life really creating a lot of negative karma, and then how, you know, what's going to ripen for them at the time of death? Yeah, they spent a lot of time, you know, plotting to kill their enemies, and, you know, what kind of karmic visions do they have? Whereas, you know, some animals, maybe, you know, mind is much more peaceful. It depends. They may not be clinging so much, and they may not be worried about how they look. Yeah, some people die worried about how they look. Remember this movie star who had a facelift after she died so that she would look good in the coffin? Yeah? So, yeah. So I remember when, you know, our cats died and, you know, we were sitting around them saying mantra and, you know, they would have seizures. You could tell they were having visions and things. But we would try and soothe them and get them calm. And, you know, I think they had pretty good deaths. And their bodies didn't decay for several days, both of them, which was really exceptional. Made us wonder who these cats really were. Yeah? Other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. You were mentioning about one of your teachers teaching Gaia and people going to somebody else. But isn't that actually the quality of magnetizing is a quality? The quality of magnetizing.
Magnetizing. Yeah.
Isn't a quality that we should develop in order to bring people to Dharma?
Oh, okay. So isn't the quality of magnetizing people a quality to develop to bring them to the Dharma? If you have Dharma realizations, or if you have a sincerity in your Dharma practice, you don't have to try to magnetize people. You don't have to try to impress them, because who you are is there, you know? The incarnation of Sirkum Rinpoche once said to me, he said, if I'm a good cook, I don't need to tell people I'm a good cook. All I need to do is make a meal and they'll know. Yeah? So, you know, you don't need to try and advertise yourself. Who you are just naturally attracts people. Whereas, you know, people are very often attracted to charisma. But somebody can have charisma without, you know, without having a Dharma mind. You know, because especially in the West, our minds, I mean, we're Hollywood minds, aren't we? We look for the glitter. Where's somebody who's attractive? Where's somebody who, you know, has some pizzazz around them? So we look for that kind of thing instead of really looking like, who is an earnest Dharma practitioner? But, you know, having said that, you know, there's some people who are very earnest Dharma practitioners, but they don't have huge followings of people. And I think when you look at it, having a huge following is not the purpose. Benefiting sentient beings is. And we all know, because we all have some teachers who have thousands of disciples. Yeah, if you're the student of you know, the head of a lineage or something, or His Holiness, thousands of disciples. Your teacher may not even know who you are. So, but we also have other teachers who we turn to, who have just a small circle of disciples who we can go and talk to and, you know, ask Dharma questions, ask for advice. So we need, you know, in the broad spectrum of themes, we need both kinds of teachers in this world. Yeah? Aside from the teachers that are famous, that really attract a lot of people, we need teachers who are much more blend in much more, that have fewer disciples, that can really give us the personal attention that we need at times. Don't you think?
I was thinking in one of the prayers that we have in the Vajrayana about magnetizing and enriching.
Yeah.
So that for qualities.
Yeah. Dedicate, and then next time we'll get into the actual meditation on death.